Have you ever thought about what it would be like to catch a giant tarpon? Would you like to find out what are the three most important factors in protecting bonefish, tarpon, and permit? Or maybe you're thinking, why are these three species always the focus of some of the biggest conservation groups out there? Today we've got Mark Rabein from the Bonefish Tarpon Trust on to break down the story and give us some guidance on what you can do today. This is the Wet Fly Swing Podcast, where we show you the best places to travel to for fly fishing, how to find the best resources and tools to prepare for that big trip, and what you can do to give back to the fish species you love. Hey, I'm Dave, host of the Wet Fly Swing Podcast. I've been fishing since I was a little kid. I grew up around a fly shop and have created one of the largest fly fishing podcasts in this country. I've also interviewed more of the greatest fly anglers than just about anyone in the world. Mark Rabein is here to share with us why bonefish, tarpon, and permit are keys to recovery. We find out what is the most important habitat to protect and some of the projects they are working on right now. And we also hear about the life history of tarpon and how old this fish can get. Hint, it's approaching the age of a human being. Very similar here. We're going to get into that. Plus, you're going to hear about Lefty Cray and you're going to get a story for Mark today. He's got a good connection, and I'm going to throw in a little bonus story at the end as well. We cover it all today and keep it high level at the same time. Let's step into it with Mark Rabein from bonefishtarpontrust.org. How you doing, Mark?
Thank you, Dave. Excited to be here. I know this has been a long time coming. It was great to meet you at IFTD, and appreciate the opportunity to talk about what we're doing here at BTT and talk fishing. That's always fun, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I know it's been a while since that event, but that was cool because I think even back then I had been hearing a lot about you guys. I think you're definitely in the, you know, saltwater world as far as the conservation stuff. I think you're like definitely one of the big names out there. So today we're going to talk about, you know, we're heading down to Belize. That's going to be a trip that we're putting together. So I'm trying to learn a little bit about that area, but just in general, I think bonefish, tarpon, trust, you know, generally, what are you doing? And if we focus it a little bit today, we might think tarpon just because I've asked a lot of people about, you know, your favorite species or whatever. And it seems like tarpon is always high on that list. So we're going to get into all that today and help people understand what they can do to kind of learn and give back to this. But before we get there, take us back into fly fishing. How'd you get into it? What's your first memory?
Yeah, no, great question. So for me, I was fortunate to start pretty young because my dad was into it, and he only got into it simply because he was making tidal Potomac River bass fishing videos, and a couple of his buddies said, hey, you know, we've got a guy that has written a bunch of books and he wants to make a video about fly fishing. My dad's like, all right, you know, the fishing video thing was kind of a hobby, part-time thing for me at a normal kind of corporate job as well. And, you know, that guy happened to be Lefty Cray. So all of a sudden my dad gets thrown into the world of fly fishing. You know, we as kids grew up, you know, Saturdays were like, go to the office, pack boxes to send a Bass Pro or all the other different, you know, fly fishing distributors of these films. And, you know, it's funny because like all these films, I talk to people about it. They're like, oh my gosh, you know, that's the film that taught me how to cast or how to tie this. And, you know, he did stuff with, you know, Clouser and Popovics and Barry and Kathy Beck. May she rest in peace. Holy cow. That was awful news. So as a kid, I got thrown into the industry and, you know, I'd run around the shows and, you know, steal Lefty's fried chicken at lunch and you know, just like hang out. And I was really fortunate to meet a lot of these folks as a kid and, you know, wasn't that into fishing as a kid, which was funny, but, you know, I was kind of always around it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's just such a great community. It's kind of fun. So from there, yeah, I played a lot of sports as a kid and that was kind of my main thing. And then when that dried up and I couldn't play anymore, I kind of filled that hole in my heart with just doing a lot of bass fishing with a fly rod. And it's you know, kind of from there spiraled out of control a little bit in a good way. We did a lot of just, you know, deer hunting and bass fishing in college because that's where, you know, where I went to school. It was great for that. And then
where was that, Mark?
Oh, that was in Elon in North Carolina.
Oh, cool.
So yeah, I could be in a deer stand in 10 minutes from my house. It was epic. And then my little radio station I worked at to make some extra money. His neighbor had this sweet little bass pond that he would let us, you know, go over there and harass. And you know, catch a ton of bass, and oh my God, it was the best. And, you know, so I had a ton of fun doing that and got really into it. And then my roommate was from Cape Coral, so we would go for spring break down there and, you know, limit ourselves to like one day at the Lanikai. And those of you who have been there, and I don't know if it's still around after the hurricane. I know they got hit pretty hard, but it was, and we got one day of spring break experience and we spend the rest of it fishing. So that was my first real taste in of Florida fishing, and we were super hooked on it. And, you know, that was kind of an annual migration every year. Then we'd get back and have spring football practice and all that. And then, you know, that was kind of the migration for us. After college, didn't want to get a real job. So I went and I, you know, some people go to Europe. I went and lived in a tent in Alaska.
Oh, there you go.
And
we're at in Alaska. What part of Alaska?
We're on the Kenai, right in Cooper Landing. So it's like you get the, you know, the insane combat fishing, which we would try to avoid, but you know, it's a big enough river. You can get away. I had this really cool mentor, a guy who goes by Fly Bob, which is arguably one of the coolest nicknames I have heard of, but you know, he kind of took me under his wing and taught me a lot. And my boss there, Colin, was really cool. And you know, worked at a fly shop there and did everything from sell fly rods and rig fly rods to clean salmon and ship salmon and, you know, do whatever it took to kind of keep things going. So it was just a great summer. And then at the end of that, we bought a really crappy Subaru back when they were like custom, you know, decked out, actually pretty cool cars. But this thing we bought for $1,600.
What year was this? Because I had a couple of those. What year was that?
So I graduated Elon in 13. And then, so that was that summer. So it had been the summer of 13. And so we bought a car and we took, you know, because none of us had jobs and we had been living in a tent over the summer. So we just saved up all of our money. You know, we were eating salmon every day for every meal.
Sure.
You know? And so we just saved up all of our money and went for about 3.5 months, drove from Alaska to Key West.
What, you drove in that Subaru?
In the $1,600 Subaru.
And what year was the actual Subaru, the car?
So the Subaru was a 92.
Oh, 92, 1992.
And it was one of those, like, every time we filled the gas, we had to kind of fill up the oil as well.
Sure.
No one really understood where the oil went. It just wasn't there.
Right. That's it. It was just burning or leaking. Was this like a big wagon so you could sleep in the back sort of thing?
Yep. It was, I've got a photo of it somewhere.
Oh, we got to get that photo. I love the old Subaru. The problem with the Subarus back in the day was they had this issue with overheating. Did it ever hit you? Did that ever get you?
Yeah, we were kind of over near Pikes Peak and trying to get up over a mountain pass. And it was a kind of a nice sunny fall day and we overheated. and we just, you know, we made it to the top and it was like kind of crapped out on us. We thought we were done. We let it sit for an hour and got back in and it was fine. So
I'll share my Subaru story, not now, but if we have time at the end, it's pretty crazy. But
I didn't know you had Subaru.
Since this rough period, I've not had one in probably 20 years, mainly because of this story. But yeah, I'll hopefully we'll have some time at the end, but keep going.
Oh yeah. So anyways, yeah, I mean, we had this thing decked out, like we painted giant orange number threes on the side of it, just like really classed it up. And we just had a ton of fun.
Yeah.
You know, did a lot of cool just fishing, hunting, hanging out with friends, meeting new friends. It was spectacular.
That's it. You did it. So you did Alaska, you did the whole thing. And then when, you know, I know we're going to skip around a little bit, but, you know, let's just take it right into the bonefish. You know, how did that opportunity, because that seems like a spot that a lot of people would like to get to work with.
Yeah, no. So that was kind of random to a degree. You know, so I had been following BTT for a couple years at that point with the journal, you know, because those are in a lot of fly shops and stuff like that. And I grew up doing a lot of bone fishing. We used to go as kids, we'd go to Exuma and, you know, really got into that at a young age. So really loved that particular style of bone fishing and just thought it was kind of cool. I was in that time of life where it's like, I don't really know specifically what I'm going to do. Just try to get a couple internships with different people, you know, growing up where I did, you know, we're very close to Washington, D.C. So, you know, I grew up with a lot of kids whose parents were pretty impressive folks within D.C. So I was very fortunate that they were kind enough to, you know, let me come work for them and get an internship and not get paid anything and, you know, get some good experience and, you know, add that to my resume. Yeah, my mom worked in the political world, so I was kind of exploring with that space. And then when I came back from Alaska, I started an internship that turned into, you know, I guess my first official job at a lobbying firm. Hmm. And
wow.
I kind of realized that, you know, I loved the people there. It was really some of the nicest and just best people I've ever met or worked for. But the space wasn't really what I imagined myself doing. And, you know, so I kind of started looking. It's like at this point in life, I don't want to get stuck into this and, you know, go down that rabbit hole and never come out of it, as a lot of people do.
Right.
So I kind of started looking at every conservation group I liked and followed them rapidly until I saw opportunity. And, you know, BTT had a marketing position, which is what I'd technically gone to college for, but it's a communications degree. So do with that what you
want. Yeah.
no knock against Elon. That's just, communications degrees are not my number one recommendation for anybody in college.
Okay.
But, you know, so that's what I had my formal training in. And, you know, I didn't get the job, but they said, hey, you know, we'll keep you in mind. You know, we can tell you really want to be involved. And you know, if something comes up, we'll let you know. I figured it was like, oh, whatever. I'm the first loser. You know, I'll never hear from these folks again. And then like 3 months later, they emailed me and said, hey, we just posted this events job. We think you'd be a good fit for it.
Hmm.
And
wow.
I had no events experience. But I was like, you know, I've thrown a keg party before. And you know, if I can figure that out,
that counts.
I can figure this out. But no, and it was just, you know, it was an entry level job and kind of a way in. And it was something that, you know, never in a million years did I think I would be, you know, jumping into the event world, but I did it. And you know, it was kind of cool. It was a new challenge. I liked it. I like, you know, the aspect I get to work with a lot of different people. You know, it's just fun traveling around and seeing folks and kind of spreading the word, so to speak. Sure. And, you know, it's like you meet anglers, you know, it's all a very passionate group and, you know, it's kind of inspiring to be around people that want to volunteer their time and efforts to help and,
mm-hmm.
You know, advance the cause really. And that's, it was really rewarding and was able to just meet so many great people. And, you know, from there, BTT's kind of kept growing. And as it grew, I was fortunately able to grow with it. And it's been honestly just a huge blessing in my life. I love the organization and love the people. And I'm currently our director of development. And, you know, it's like, it comes back to the people. Like this, we as an organization, we're not supported by some giant fund out there of, you know, government grants or this and that. And maybe one day we'll start to get into some of those a little bit better and we'll have some larger projects. But, you know, BTT, for the most part, up until this point, is something that's been funded by people who care, whether it's, you know, just anglers, conservationists, people who love Florida, the Bahamas, Belize, Mexico, I mean, you name it. You know, it's like, we're alive because of the community. And, that's pretty inspiring to me.
Wow. Yeah, that is inspiring. I think that's like that grassroots stuff. And I've seen it. I mean, just in the time we've been doing this podcast over the last, you know, not quite 10 years now, you know, it seems like, yeah, you guys just keep getting bigger and bigger and more impact. So that's cool. And I love that you mentioned the events because, you know, I've been the last few years putting together these events for podcast listeners and I know how much work it is to do it right. Right. And, but now you go from events into, and now describe your job now. What is, you mentioned the title, but what do you do exactly?
Yeah. So essentially as director of development, my job is to, you know, engage our stakeholders. So the people that continue to support us, engage them to the best of my ability. And, you know, the easiest way to describe it is I'm selling science to people. It's like, look, we need your support to keep this stuff going.
this is what we're doing. These are the science, you know, research projects we've got. These are the policy objectives we've got. You know, here are our 5-year goals that, you know, how it all kind of aligns together, and we need your support to get there. So, you know, it's a lot of just conversations with people to continue their connection to the organization, whether it's in a volunteer role or financially or working with corporate sponsors to come up with new fun opportunities to, you know, collaborate. You know, it's kind of a mix of everything. So I'm still in charge of events. We've got a couple of event folks that work with us that are really great, you know, to help, you know, carry that load. As you mentioned, it's a big lift, but they're a ton of fun. So we've got, I will plug our 2 big events this year. So Isla Mirada Circle of Honor, will be May 2nd. So come down for tarpon season. We're inducting the legendary Captain Rick Ruoff. And then we have also 2 posthumous honorees, Captain Joe Gonzalez and Captain Travis Holman, who both, I was looking at the stats just to go off on a sidebar.
Yeah.
I was looking at the stats on both of those guys. I mean, all 3 of these guys are wildly impressive, but I knew Joe pretty well. And he was one of the first guides I really ever connected with at BTT because he was local here in Miami, and he tagged 1,300 bonefish.
Wow.
It's like, I mean, just insane. And I was talking to Bear Holman, Travis's brother, the other day. And, you know, we were just telling, he was telling Travis stories. And I mean, that guy was just, he was awesome. I mean, he really made that you know, project permit thing kind of to the next level. I mean, he was the guy that was sort of an ambassador to the guide community and took our scientist guys in and showed them around and helped them tag a ton of fish. And yeah, I'm just excited. So that's gonna be cool, man. All 3 gentlemen, and then Rick obviously is just a legend in the Keys, you know, super heavy work with Everglades. And you know, he's on the BTT board now, so he's been a great guy to, you know, have and be an advocate, and just really intelligent individual who knows the fishery better than just about anybody. So
gotcha. Wow.
3 absolute studs. We're pretty excited about that one.
That's awesome. So you have these are 2 big events coming up here this year.
So that's Isla Mirada. So that's the one May 2nd. We call that the Circle of Honor. We do that at Chica Lodge. It's pretty sweet. Yeah, just great space there. It's kind of like a big homecoming. You know, it's we invite all of our previous honorees to come hang out.
Sure.
It's kind of a cool Rolodex of flats fishing folks. And yeah, so that's a ton of fun. And then the other big one is in October. I think it's the 15th this year. And that's going to be the big New York dinner. And that's another kind of really cool marquee event for us. And we're honoring Bob Rich this year and maybe one other potential individual we're waiting to hear back. So that's going to be another cool event.
Imagine your perfect cast in the pristine waters of Bristol Bay, the heart of the Alaskan wilderness. Togiak Lodge sits in this unique paradise, offering unmatched fishing amidst breathtaking landscapes. Envision yourself right now amidst nature's best, with every fish narrating its own epic tale. You can visit TogiakLodge.com right now. That's Togiak, T-O-G-I-A-K. Your story woven into the fabric of Bristol Bay, where every cast is a memory, every fish is unforgettable. Imagine yourself surrounded by pristine waters, towering mountains, and the thrill of landing a trophy fish like the majestic Arctic grayling or the elusive bull trout. Take a look for yourself at nradventures.com/wetflyswing and discover the Northern Rockies like never before. That's N as in Northern, R as in Rockies, adventures.com. You support this podcast by checking in at nradventures.com. And we'll definitely have links in the show notes to some of these events, and just I think there's probably plenty of spots on your website people can follow up. But you mentioned the tagging, which I think is probably going to fit into some of our discussion today about that. But maybe we can dig into a little bit on, you know, like we said, it's bonefish, tarpon, trust permit, and there's, I mean, lots of other species out there. But as far as tarpon, maybe you could talk about that. What maybe give us a high level, you know, what you guys do with tarpon and some of these programs, or maybe some highlight a couple.
Sure. Well, you know, like, you got to look at all 3 of these species as kind of keystone species that, you know, if we're able to protect these three, we're able to do a whole lot more.
And why is that? So why are these three species? Because you've got like snook, you've got tons of other species. Why are these three the big ones?
I mean, historically, I would say, you know, so all right, so let's go back to BTT's history. Like, yeah. BTT was originally founded. The initial idea was we need to do something about the population of bonefish in the Keys because it was declining so rapidly in the mid to late 90s. So we had a number of local guides and local stakeholders that, you know, fished with those guides and cared about the fishery. They came together and said, hey, look, let's raise a little bit of money to do some research because we need to figure out what's going on. We have no idea. And unfortunately, you know, like these particular species, it's not like there's a commercial fishery for them where they have established, you know, stock assessments and things like that. There's just no information on them. So we had to kind of create the baseline and do all the research ourselves, which, you know, it took a long time. It was a big kind of mountain to climb, and, you know, it was just slow going.
Is that where you start with, say, bonefish, and you just start doing like mark recapture to figure out like how many fish roughly are out there?
Yeah, I mean, they've done a ton of different science over the years. I mean, it was everything from tagging with dart tags to, you know, like you're saying, you know, mark recaptured stuff. You know, the technology has advanced a little bit, and so has our technique, and so has our information. So, you know, as things have progressed, it's like we now have this kind of great stockpile of data. And this is thanks to not just BTT people, but the whole community that's been around to help. I mean, I mentioned the three guides that we're honoring in Isla Mirada, but, you know, beyond that, I mean, there's so many people that have been a part of this process that, you know, maybe we'll be able to honor them one of these days, but there's just a huge list of people that have been super supportive of this work. And mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of it is thankless and a lot of it goes unmentioned, and you know, but it's it needed to be done, and it's part of a greater movement. And you know, you see some of the progress we're making, you see some of these outcomes that we're starting to see, and you know, it's really exciting. But you know, going back to sort of how it all came together, I think, you know, starting with bonefish, that was sort of the original goal, but then everyone kind of realized the interconnectivity of these species and their habitats. You know, it's like they all three tend to use pretty similar habitats. And, you know, it's like these issues are also larger than just, you know, localized, you know, this particular flat is not doing well because of this one issue. You know, it's like if there was one silver bullet to fix all this stuff, it would have been fixed a long time ago.
Yeah, there's a ton. What are those things, if you have to narrow it down into the, I know in Florida, like water, you know, quality is huge. What are, like, if you had to say high level, just, you know, these species, what are the big impacts if you had to narrow it down into a few?
Yeah, I mean, our kind of guiding principles these days are habitat, water quality, and fisheries management. You know, those are the three things that we're really focused on. And then each one of those has a lot of different tentacles, and each tentacle kind of varies by region, right?
Mm.
But, you know, you look at the state of Florida, the amount of habitat we're losing at such a rapid rate. You look at the, you know, diminishing water quality and all these issues. And, you know, there's a lot of doom and gloom, but I think, you know, one of the things that BTT does a good job of doing is providing a pathway to, like, look, we know what's happening. There's data. There's a ton of awareness. I mean, we all know what's going on, but these are the solutions we need to pursue. And these are solutions based on, you know, a lot of research, right?
You're right. You guys aren't just like you said, politics at the start. This is not like you're coming in and just making something up and being like, hey, this is what we think. This is literally science, and it's documented, and it's all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, for me, that's, you know, and relating back to my role, like, that's a solid foundation to work from. And I think that's, you know, Dr. Adams, who I hope you get to meet one of these days. He's one of the most inspiring individuals I've ever met. You know, one of his favorite phrases is, you gain credibility by the thimbleful and lose it by the bucketful.
Oh, wow. I love that. Can you say that again? Because I think that quote needs to go in our in the show notes.
Yeah, no, sorry. I'm stumbling on my tongue over
That's
here.
That's a good one.
So Aaron's, Dr. Aaron Adams, who's our head of science over here, and, you know, the guy who kind of really got all this, got us to where we are, arguably. But, you know, one of his favorite quotes is, you gain credibility by the thimbleful and lose it by the bucketful.
Right. You gain credibility by the thimbleful and you lose it by the bucket.
Yeah. And that's kind of a guiding principle for everything you do, right? It's got to be based in the facts, right? You know, any type of outcome, goal, whatever we set, it's got to be heavily based in what we're seeing and how it relates to the fishery and how it relates to the science. So, you know, these guys, they have a pretty high standard, and that's, you know, I love to see that. And you know, I think people that support us love to see that as well, because they know, you know, their dollar's not going to get wasted on pursuing some speculative idea. It's, you know, this is the right path forward.
This is good. Okay. So we got habitat, water, fish management. I'm assuming, yeah, that's a huge category, which includes all sorts of things in there. But within that, if you take it to, say, tarpon, for example, I mean, do you guys have like a, I'm sure you don't know kind of everywhere, but let's just take it to Belize, for example, and some of these are focused, but do you know how well, say, tarpon or these species are doing down there? Or is it one of those things where, you know, you're kind of still working on that?
So, you know, that goes back, and I will preface this. I'm not a scientist, but I've been around the organization. I know, you know, basically some of the guiding principles. And one of the things we've never pursued, and it's come up a lot, is a stock assessment of these fish. You know, I don't think it's ever been attempted, and we'll have to double check that. Like I said, I don't know the history
and,
of it.
And stock assessment essentially means like how much of, like, say, tarpon in the world or the region there are right now.
Right,
versus exactly. say 10 years ago or 100 years ago.
And there's no way to do that in a comprehensive way, as far as I understand it.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is what we look at. You know, speaking of tarpon, not specifically in Belize, but coming back to here in the Keys, you know, one of the ways that our science team quantifies this data is by looking at different tournament catch records. And you look at, you know, the number of releases, the number of jumped fish, oh, right. Things like that.
Yeah.
And you can then, you know, value the health of a fishery. And you've got, you know, with like some of these tarpon tournaments, years and years and
That's
years.
Right.
Of and, you know, working with folks like the IGFA who keep all these kind of records as well. You know, the Lower Keys Guides Association, Florida Keys Fishing Guides Association, all, you know, and I'm probably leaving folks out and I apologize. But, you know, we actually just completed a big study trying to scientifically document these type of historic declines, specifically with tarpon, just to sort of give ourselves a baseline of where we are. So it's like, you know, it goes back to being strategic with different initiatives. You know, like historically, everyone's assumption is to do a stock assessment. And, you know, it's like that's the way it's typically done. You know, for us, that costs a lot of money. And I would say it's probably not the most efficient way to get to the result that we need to learn. Right. It's like, it's not going to be conclusive enough, and we can prove it with similar, but different sets of data. So.
Yeah. Gotcha. No, this is, and I want to highlight, cause we're just talking, Monty Burke was on episode 474, cool. Lords of the Fly. And that really was an amazing story because it talks about the tarpon and the collapse, I think, right. Because of a lot of issues, but
right.
So you have right. that going, but yeah, so I think where you're coming from is, yeah, some of this data you don't have necessarily, you don't know exactly how many tarpon there are in the world, but you do, you can extrapolate. It sounds like maybe from some of the fishing data that, and get a rough idea and, you know, just generally, just like steelhead, for example, you know, out west, we know things are not going well in some areas, and you can just see that by fishing, you know.
Right.
And so that's kind of where you guys are coming from. Like, anything else we want to highlight here, just from, you know, so people, or maybe places to go, who would be the person that could dig deep into the tarpon, you know, this topic?
So it depends on what size of tarpon, right. I guess. All right. So,
yeah,
you know, I guess depending on where you want to go with this, like we have a lot of really cool work going on in Southwest and kind of the west coast of Florida with juvenile tarpon. And just to go on a small plug
for
Joellen Wilson over there, you know, she's created this whole vulnerability index and worked with a ton of different folks over there to essentially create a roadmap for potential habitat protections longer term. They've started in an area called Rookery Bay. So they've got this great habitat restoration that they've already, you know, begun, and ground is actually being moved on. And then we're currently looking about 4 to 6 others that are potential next steps for habitat improvement. And, you know, essentially the goal of this is to improve degraded habitats, identify habitats that are in good shape, and, you know, monitor them at, for basically the healthiness of the habitat. And then, you know, if there are other habitats that we can help kind of build up and restore, you know, identifying any of those and kind of setting them up for this long process of how do we work with our partners within the state to, you know, get them on a list to maybe be protected, maybe be enhanced, maybe prevent them from getting bulldozed over.
Sure.
You know, a lot of different threats. Maybe, you know, figure out ways to get them better water quality.
Right.
You know, each situation is kind of unique. But at the end of the day, it's like we've lost, you know, I think it's something like 50% or more of our habitat
here in the habitat. Oh, right. And so that's it. So talk about that. So the habitat that we're talking about here, and maybe you can talk about Jones. Was it Joan Wilson?
Joellen.
Yeah. So talk about what is the habitat restoration? What is the actual work they're doing? They're fixing.
Yeah. So the particular one in Rookery Bay is sort of a reconnection back to the water. You know, we've seen this in other places as well. You know, when construction happens, especially, you know, back in the day where people didn't really understand exactly how watersheds maybe worked, or it's just like, how do we get this done in the most the least expensive way possible? You know, they would build just a lot of roads and block stuff off and not build culverts. And, you know, just like the Everglades, right?
Yep.
You know, prime example. Wasn't necessarily malicious, but they didn't do it any favors either. So, you know, it's kind of, I wouldn't say reverse engineering, but just bringing it back to a
reconnecting, basically opening it up so fish can kind of go naturally where they want to go to the habitats.
That's it. And, you know, from there, you know, the environment's very resilient. It's going to take care of itself, but we got to give it a little boost as well. So
that's awesome. Cool. No, this is good. I think that, like we said, today is going to be high level just because you guys, you know, do so much out there. And I think what we'll do is, you know, moving ahead, we might track down some of your scientists and dig deeper into, you know, all these species and maybe some projects too. I think this is really interesting.
Yeah. Well, that would be, you know, we've got, you know, Dr. Ross is probably a good guy to talk to for Florida Keys. They've got some really cool stuff going down there. He's been involved with the process for many years. So he'd probably be a good guy to talk to for Florida-based stuff. And, you know, for juvenile tarpon, Joellen is definitely the main point of contact on our staff. And obviously Aaron is, you know, in charge of all of this stuff. So he can speak to all of it a lot.
Gotcha. Do you know a little bit on the life history of a tarpon? Could you describe that a little bit?
Yeah, no. So they're pretty interesting, you know, from what we know, similar to like what bonefish do, they go offshore to spawn in really deep areas and, you know, they mix in the ocean, they shoot their shot, so to speak, and mix it and becomes this small, what's called a leptocephalus stage. And it's, you know, think of like a tadpole. And, you know, I know in bonefish, it's like after 48 hours, it becomes this little tiny ribbon. I'm not sure what's the timeline with tarpon, but essentially they become this sort of tadpole leptocephalus stage, and they start to migrate towards certain habitats. And, you know, they're kind of at the mercy of wind and current just because, you know, at that stage in life, there's they have a tail and like a nose, and that's pretty much it, right? And obviously heart, you know, starting to build out lungs and all these other things. And then eventually, you know, the currents kind of bring them, currents, tides, winds, whatever, bring them to habitat that's either suitable or not for them. And that's why, you know, you see tarpon in all kinds of
kind of crazy habitats where you wouldn't think they might be. You know, like you think of like the videos of tarpon in a golf course pond, or, you know, places where there might not be a connection to the ocean, but at some point it flooded and they were able to drift in there. You know, same thing like here in Miami, we've got all these canals that a buddy of mine, Eric Estrada, you know, he used to take, when he was living in Miami, he used to take me around and fish these canals that are the nastiest places you've ever seen, but there's a little tarpon all in them. And it's pretty wild. So, you know, they're relatively resilient, but at the same time, with so much habitat loss going on, you know, and such a long lifespan, how sustainable is it at this point?
How old are can tarpon get?
You know, I'm probably going to get this wrong, but I've heard of some being up to like 80 years old.
Yeah, right. That's right. That's crazy.
You got to think like how far has a fish like that migrated, right? And what have they seen? And, you know,
and even 40, I mean, even if the fish was only 40 years old or even 20, right, would be a lot, but I mean, 80 is just like, think of the, you know, one fish, you know, you impact one fish, that makes a major impact. Cause I'm guessing they spawn multiple times over their lifetime.
Yeah. Yeah. And still, I mean, we still don't know, you know, a ton on that. That's kind of ongoing stuff.
That's ongoing.
You know,
you gotta
focus on what is attainable and, you know, reasonable research wise. So.
Gotcha. So the life history of, like you said, so they spawn somewhere out in the deep water. They come back into the, basically they in these mangroves, is that kind of where they just grow as juveniles and eventually migrate out to spawning? Is that kind of life history?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, they grew up in these mangrove estuaries. And part of what Joe Ellen was doing early on was figuring out what is the optimal habitat, you know, like bottom structure, mangrove cover, you know, differing factors of vegetation and grass and size of a canal or size of a creek, you know, things like that. And it's also great juvenile snook habitat. So that's another kind of nice crossover there. I love me some snook.
You do. Snook is good. So that goes back to the question.
Not eating. I don't eat them.
Okay.
I love me catching some snook. I gotta specify that because a lot of people like eating them.
Oh, they do.
Not a huge fan of. I mean, I encourage people not to eat them, just because I love them so much, which is selfish. And you know, I do eat fish. So
what's the fish you eat most out there?
You know, I love going out with my neighbor and my buddy Dave, and we do some mahi fishing, just because I feel good that mahi are very sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
They're delicious. Everybody likes them.
Yep.
And you can oftentimes catch some, you know, blackfin tunas and stuff like that too. You know, obviously love a, you know, grouper.
Yep. So there's tons. So there's, you have these, the fish we're talking about here, which I guess aren't really, have never been commercial because they're not good to eat. Is that the case with the tarpon and bonefish and snook?
I mean, so we can break those down individually. Like a bonefish is still technically the national dish of the Bahamas. Like, you know, historically it was very famously eaten there. I mean, it's on the 10-cent piece.
So actually bonefish does taste good?
I mean, I've never eaten it. I talked to people who have, and it's like, you know.
Right. Yeah.
It's called a bonefish because it's full of bones and it's a pain in the rear to clean. And then like the Hawaiians, they have their version of it that they eat, you know, it's a big thing over there. They call it, I think it's ohio. I probably butchered the pronunciation of that, but you know, I've seen like videos and stuff of it. You know, people send me videos like, oh, this is wrong. I'm like, I mean, it's not illegal, unfortunately. I mean, it's not cool. I hate to see a big bonefish get eaten, but you know, it's also
part of their natural, part of their culture. I mean, that's hard.
Yeah, it's part of their culture. It's like, who am I to say, you know,
exactly.
Let's say, you can't do that.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of crossover, I think probably with a lot of indigenous tribes. I mean, again, going back to like the Northwest, salmon, steelhead, all that. I mean, lots of, you know, indigenous people have done that for thousands of years, have harvested,
right.
But it's tough when you start to see Chinook collapsing and these species and to think like, wow, we're going to keep, you know, killing those fish when we're on the brink in some places, right? It's the same thing, it sounds like, for tarpon and other species.
Yeah. Well, and it's like you look at, you know, what a lot of folks are doing. Obviously, being in conservation, I love kind of learning from other groups and seeing what other folks are doing.
So they're opening up that big dam. I forget the name of it.
Which one is this in the?
It was like the largest dam removal just happened. I'm trying.
Up in the Northwest.
Yeah, the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, it was the Elwha Dam.
Yeah, the Elwha. I mean, that was cool. And that's like, you think of like with what we're doing with habitat restoration, here's kind of the same idea. It's, you know, just kind of opening up these waterways to historic access and, you know, just different environment. And it's cool to see stuff like that. And it's amazing to see, you know, how resilient nature can be. You know, even after all of the harm we as humans have caused, and you know, it gives me hope, and I think it should give other people hope that, you know, you look at projects like that and you see these, you know, all kinds of different conservation groups doing all kinds of good stuff. It's that's what it takes, you know.
Step into the world where the river whispers and the fishing is nothing short of legendary. This year, I ventured into the heart of eastern Idaho's Yellowstone Teton territory, where the fish were larger than life and the waters held the secrets of the best fly fishing out west. Yellowstone Teton territory is not just a location, it's a gateway to adventures that will etch themselves into your memory. With crystal clear rivers like the Henry's Fork and the South Fork of the Snake, and enough lakes to keep you going all year long, make your way to Yellowstone Teton territory and embark on a journey to one of North America's finest fly fishing destinations. Whether you're planning your trip now or just dreaming it up, the YTT is where those dreams turn into reality. Remember, Yellowstone Teton Territory. That's Teton, T-E-T-O-N. It's time to experience Eastern Idaho for yourself and support this podcast at the same time. Today's episode is sponsored by Togan's Fly Shop. Togan's Fly Shop provides superior quality products at a great price. They have also a great YouTube channel that you can check out right now with new fly tying tutorials each week. Togan's also has you covered if you're looking for unique in-house products, and they also support many of the great brands out there that you know and trust. It's been fun connecting with Justin and the family over the years now, and it's been really cool, a great local fly shop. Togan's is also offering their fly tying box, where they send out materials at a regular cadence where you don't even have to think of it. You just open the mailbox and there's your Togan's pack. And I recently made an order through Togan's, and the experience is always perfect. They've got you covered if you ever have questions or need any help, whether that's a YouTube tutorial or connecting with them personally. Since 2005, Togan's has been over delivering on customer service, and it's time for you to check out Togan's Buzz for yourself. You can head over to wetflyswing.com/Togan's right now to check out their diverse selection of products today. You support this podcast by clicking through that link to Togan's online. That's Togan's, T-O-G-E-N-S. Okay, back to the show. No, I think the hope is for sure. I mean, just like groups like yourself, you know, we've gone back to the, you know, a recent episode we had, you know, with Yvonne Chouinard and Patagonia, and you know, they give out a lot of money and they're a great partner and supporter, but they say that, you know, the local groups, right? That's where you got to focus on. And I think you guys are probably started local. You're probably even bigger now, but I feel like you always start on the ground. Is that the same thing for this? Are you guys looking at other groups that are doing great stuff on the ground and trying to support them? Or are you guys still the local group?
You know, I think it's a mix of everything. And you look at, and we've got a whole partners tab on the website. I mean, we I think are kind of a connectivity to a lot of different groups, you know, and that's sort of been our model. It's like we want to be as efficient as possible. Yeah. So like if there's another group doing something and they're crushing it, there's no reason for us to go do that, right? It's like we want to be efficient with the support we've been, you know, really blessed with. And you know, like we have to play well in the sandbox with everybody for all of this to work. And you look at some big things that are happening, you know, specifically here in Florida and abroad, you know, we've got a lot of great partners in that, you know, whether it's, you know, Everglades restoration, whether it's this Rookery Bay project, a lot of this different scientific work. We work with a ton of great universities. Shout out FIU as a Panther.
Oh, FIU. Okay.
FIU. They're great. They're a great partner, but I also went there for grad school. So
oh, nice.
FIU and Jen Rehaj and her lab. Good people. And then, like, you look at the Bahamas, you know, we've created and been part of this Bahamas Mangrove Alliance. You know, they've got this new opportunity to plant 1 million mangroves by the end of 2025. And, you know, there's a whole list of great partners plugged in there. So it's, you know, we do our best to try to partner up with others. And there's groups that really knock it out of the park on certain things. And, you know, it's like we try to leave everybody to, you know, follow their speciality and advise or listen or
support. Yeah.
Support as needed.
That's cool. What is the, again, we're hitting some high level, topics here, but the mangroves, you know, how would you describe those for somebody who's never seen a mangrove, like what it is, you know, what it's the benefits to fish and all that?
Yeah. So, it's the home to a lot of juvenile species that, you know, without them, we also lose a lot of coastal resiliency. So there's a lot of great kind of easy talking points, and you hear about mangroves a lot with this new kind of emphasis in the past few years on blue carbon initiatives. Mm. And, you know, a lot of people are, especially those in the carbon market, we are not, we just want to plant more mangroves and enhance habitat. But you hear a lot of people talk about the blue carbon market and, you know, the benefits that it has. And basically these plants sequester a lot of carbon. They provide coastal resiliency. They're relatively easy to maintain and plant and get out there. So, you know, from that side of things, that's the interest. But for us, you know, these places are perfect habitat. They, you know, they have a lot of benefits to the watershed beyond just, you know, some of the normal operations of the plant, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these are kind of our safe havens for a lot of different fish, and different fish kind of use them differently. You know, like juvenile tarpon and snook really rely on these mangrove nurseries to kind of get bigger and stay protected and hide from predators, and then also learn how to, you know, hunt and grow and put on mass. Whereas in the Bahamas, you know, the bonefish on certain tides will slide into the mangroves to get away from predators, or, you know, these mangroves also produce a lot of different prey items that they like. And, you know, it kind of depends on which specific environment you're in, but at the end of the day,
mangroves are good. But yeah. More, you say more mangroves, more money.
No, I said more mangroves, more better.
Oh, more better. Okay.
It's just,
yeah, that's right. Well, and like you said, it's just, basically protection. Yeah. So the root system, it kind of, you know, looks like kind of provides the, yeah, they can hide. And then when they get bigger, as they get bigger, I'm sure that now they're on the outside eating the fish that are trying to get out. Right. So this is, yeah. Gotcha.
And to describe it, I mean, I don't know how you describe it as someone who's maybe never seen one. That's kind
of
tough.
Yeah. We'll put some links in the show notes to some photos of like, we'll throw some stuff to Florida and maybe Belize as far as the mangroves. Yeah. It's just essentially some plants, vegetation, all that. And then you mentioned the blue carbon, which is, I guess, the ocean's ability to sequester carbon. That's kind of the focus. I haven't really heard about the blue carbon, but that sounds like that's a big focus now for some folks.
I mean, For BTT, it's about enhancing habitat and improving fishery and protecting coastal communities. That's the focus. But, you know, there's an interest with a lot of different organizations out there as some of these ESG initiatives kind of grow and scale. And you look at things like, you know, these different policies that are in place where people need to sequester X amount of carbon, this and that. You know, there's an initiative there for people to plant more mangroves. So it's like if we can tap into that momentum and get more habitat work done, why not?
Perfect. This is awesome. So, so we're going to take it out of here in a little bit, but before we get there, just want to see if we're, you know, I know we are missing a lot and this is kind of high level, but anything else you want to shout out to Bonefish Tarpon Trust or anything we didn't cover today, any places we, you know, people can go, that sort of thing.
Oh man.
Yeah. You got, well, your website, when you look at your website, I look at the links. I'm like, everyone has like, you know, eight, 10 things to drop down. So there is a ton of resources there, conservation, education, get involved, you know, store. So I think, yeah, I think probably the best thing would be just to send people over to the website to take a look.
Yeah. And so the website's a great resource. You know, all of our journals are on there digitally. So if you want to get caught up and really deep dive, every single journal we've ever produced is on there. So that's a pretty cool resource.
tons of really cool data in the journals. You know, we've got memberships and stuff like that. If you want to be on the list to get a journal every year.
Oh, cool.
You know, you can sign up for a membership. We've got a level that fits everybody. And that's just a good way to kind of stay plugged in. You know, beyond that, we just appreciate the support of the community. We're just, you know, we're so appreciative of everyone that kind of keeps us going. And we're excited to hopefully continue to earn that support and trust as we go. You know, just want to say thank you to all the people that have been a part of this process along the way. It's a community effort. You know, no, I don't think any one person or entity should take credit. And we're just happy to be involved in the process.
Perfect. No, this is great. And I think we're going to get into our shout out segment here. And that's perfect. And then we'll take it out of here in a bit. So today's shout out is, we're just fresh off of this. Matt, Effler from Atlanta, Georgia, just won. We did our big event. We're heading up to Alaska, up to another conservation area, up to Bristol Bay. We're going to be fishing up there. And he won a trip, over $11,000 worth of, the trip and the gear. It was a pretty amazing. We did a live event last night, and shout out to Rio Reddington. They gave away some rod and a reel and some other great gear. But let's go to that. So that's our shout out for today. What is, you know, for you, we haven't talked gear at all. What's your one piece of gear when you're fishing out there, you know, on the flats or wherever, that you don't leave without? What's that big thing you need?
Oh man.
I guess you don't need much, right? That's the thing about the,
I mean, well, yeah, the biggest one is sunglasses.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a, I guess we met through the Costa folks.
Oh yeah.
They've been a huge supporter of BTT. You know, they've got their own project they've been a part of. You know, I love everybody on that end, just good people, super supportive, good product. So that's one thing that's, you know, not worth getting on the boat if you don't have a good pair of polarized sunglasses.
What are your glasses? What do you love the lens style?
I've got the Reefton Pros right now.
Reefton Pro.
Okay. As my fishing sunglasses, and they're pretty spectacular. They fit tight to the face and don't let extra light in, but they're not uncomfortable.
Yeah. Is that a, is that like a, what's the color of the lens?
I do just the green mirror.
Yeah. Green mirror.
You know, those tend to do well, but I also have like a set of yellow, you know, light. I forget the name of the lens, but it's that yellow kind of.
Yeah. The yellow, like the low light stuff.
Yeah, the low light ones. Yeah, that's really great. I use those duck hunting as well, actually. So those are pretty spectacular. And then it's like if we have pretty overcast weather like we've been having here, it can really help you see a lot that you wouldn't otherwise. So those are great. And then I still love my truck glasses are the Spiro XLs. They're the most comfortable sunglasses I've ever owned. And I need a new pair.
Is that Costa?
Yeah, they're Costas. They're Costas.
Spiro, okay.
And mine are getting a little ratty and got a couple big scratches on them. So
oh, yeah.
I'm gonna lay that out there.
Gotcha. Yeah, yeah. No, I think we definitely love Costa for sure. And as we put this together, you know, I think they might be part of the partnership here. So this is okay. Awesome. Yeah, no, we love Costa as well. I think there's a lot of great companies out there doing good stuff. So cool. And then, so let's get into a couple, just one, you know, story. You mentioned, you know, we talked lefty at the start. Do you have, I always love to get a good lefty story. Do you have any stories from your dad or anything else you want to shed light on to give people that I never met lefty like myself?
Man, I mean, one of the biggest things for those who kind of know him well is like, you know, he was kind of known for his one-liners.
Yeah.
And he's got, and I've got a link here somewhere. For one of the New York events we did years ago, from the film stuff that BTT did, they have a whole compilation of lefty one-liners. And it's one of my favorite things ever. And I think it's the best way to kind of describe him and his humor to people. Just because this, you know, he's a guy that, you know, he went through the Battle of the Bulge.
Right.
He was a guy that he shot quarters out of the air at the state fair with, you know, two hands.
Oh, that's
he was
right.
Ambidextrous, like,
yeah.
Just the coolest. Yeah, he was a commercial cat fisherman at one point. Yeah, I just think he's the coolest dude ever.
Just a life. He not only was a great, you know, angler and all that, but he had all these other things that he was great at, right?
He's just a quality human being. I think that's kind of the core takeaway. It's like, yeah, everybody knows him for his fishing, but like, I think he was really famous just because he was such a nice, caring person. And you know, he had such a passion for it. You know, I try to, you know, if I'm having a bad day or something's, you know, frustrating or whatever, I try to think of, you know, I've got a little bit of Lefty legacy that I've got to live up to since he wrote me that note. So I kind of always try to think about that. And I can't let him down.
I love that. And even myself, it shows you how much of an impact. I mean, lots of people have talked about him, but I always have this kind of saying too, like, what would Lefty do? You know, like in the back of my head, even though I never met him, just thinking like, I know, I've heard the stories.
And he's a classy dude. You know, he really was. Like I said, they don't make him like that anymore. I mean, he seriously broke the mold. Yeah, that's for sure.
That's it. Okay, cool. Well, and let's get a couple other quick random ones, then we'll take it out of here. So you mentioned sports was, so football, was that your, that was your main sport?
Yeah, yeah. So I actually went to Elon to play football and was sort of plagued by injuries, unfortunately. And when that happened, you know, I had more time. You know, it's like it's kind of amazing what college football, how much of your schedule it can eat up.
Right. Yeah. So you played college football, which is definitely not a lot of people can make it at that level.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say I played because I was pretty much injured the entire time.
Yeah.
But I attended college to play football and it didn't really work out as I hoped.
What position were you?
I was a left tackle.
Oh, left tackle, that's on defense?
Offensive left tackle.
Oh, left tackle. Yeah, so you're protecting just on the line, protecting
protecting the quarterback.
Gotcha.
And, you know, I was fortunate. You know, I was able to stay involved with the team, and all my best friends were guys, mostly guys from the team, a couple other guys that I met along the way, too. But, you know, it was a blessing to go there. Great school, loved it. And, you know, when I got hurt, essentially, I put that sort of same energy into my fishing and hunting, and I credit that for kind of shifting my whole life path, just because I kind of value that stuff
there more
than a lot of other things.
That's amazing. I feel like that happens a lot. I think sports is good for a lot of people, especially early, because it keeps you on track instead of getting in trouble. And it did for me too, but but also things happen. And at the time you think like, oh my God, we had, you know, heard the story just recently about somebody that broke his leg. You know, he was a baseball star. And because of that, you know, he ended up doing something else. And it turns out that something else has been life-changing. And it sounds like that's the same thing for you.
Oh, 100%. I mean, you look at even down here, like two of the guides that kind of pop into my mind that were athletes, like Greg Deeney, he played baseball somewhere. It was really good from what I understand. And like Rob Fordyce was the same way.
Oh yeah.
And those guys are, you know, both amazing guides. I mean, I think, you know, athletes definitely have a kind of a certain switch in them that when you can't compete, you got to figure out something to fill that gap. And for me, it was sort of that pursuit of, you know, really anything in nature. And then it's kind of refined from there. Based on my interests.
That's it. Nice. Well, do you want to hear a quick, give you the quick Subaru story, then we'll take it out here.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I want to hear about the Subaru and any type of good Subaru story.
Are you still a Subaru? Are you now drive a Subaru, or what's your car of choice?
No, I have a Toyota pickup truck. So I couldn't really fit in the Subaru. I'm 6'6".
Oh, wow.
Obviously people can't see me.
Gosh, that's right. You're giant.
Yeah.
6'6". So what was your fighting weight? It was 6'6" and what? How many pounds?
I mean, my like good weight was probably 295.
Wow. Wow. So almost 3. Yeah, you were definitely a football player. You're a giant. I remember we had this friend back in the day who was also a college football player, and he was 6'6". God, I don't remember his weight, but I remember it was weird because he was a huge guy, but he was super quick, like as quick as anybody. And was that kind of your case too? Were you like fast?
Yeah. I was never the strongest. But I definitely worked on my speed more than anything. I think that was kind of how I had an edge. And just, you know, having a big frame, big body. Like I remember like my shuttle time, I could consistently run like in the 40, I had like a 5.1, 5.2. And one time I ran a 4.9, but no one believed me. I did have a witness to that. That was only at like 275 though, but I could run like a 4.4 shuttle, like clockwork.
And what is that? And what is the 4.4?
And the shuttle is a drill where it's like 10 yards laterally each way.
Oh, yeah.
Essentially. So it's just that side to side kind of, you know.
Yeah. And the 4.4 is like seconds, like in 4 or 5 seconds.
Yeah, so it's like basically I could cover almost 30 yards in 4.4 seconds.
Oh man, yeah, that's
but like kind of laterally, if that makes
right,
sense.
Right, laterally.
Shuttle drill is one of those. It's kind of a weird short term movement drill versus a 40, which is long term movement. And it's like for a lineman, you're 40. You know, it doesn't matter as much in my opinion as a shuttle. But
yeah,
I don't know.
Oh sure, yeah, because you are going back and forth trying to protect the quarterback side to side.
Yeah. No, exactly.
That's it. Right. Wow. Okay, cool. So, well, I'll just share this. This will be long story short, but so we had this, my brother had this 1978 Subaru wagon, and this thing was, it was not in good shape, and it literally had the gear, I think it had an automatic, and the gear went out, or the gears kind of went out, but it had second gear, and,
okay.
And there was no insurance on it at the time, and I decided, and I think my mom even said, you know, this was back, I think, in high school sometime, like, do not drive this car. And so we drove the car up the mountain, and because there were some friends partying up there or whatever, got up there, I'm driving down this road, and sure enough, up in front of us as I'm driving is a cop car in the middle of nowhere up on the mountain, and he stops us and says, hey, you know, can I have your insurance and all this stuff? And we drove away, or basically we ran out of gas too. That was the other problem. We were on empty. And the cop basically gave me a ticket for no seatbelt, expired tags, I think, and no insurance. And so I had to drive the car down the hill back to the gas station, which was like 30 miles away, call my mom and tell her we're running out of gas. And she had to drive up an hour to pick us up. So anyways, that was my story.
I bet that was a serious butt whooping.
Yeah, that was about as bad as one of the worst I've been. And it always comes down to your friends, right? You're with the wrong people. So that was part of that period of my life, and it was a good learning lesson, but yeah, that was definitely one where my mom was not happy. And and then of course the insurance too, shout out to Farmers, actually it was State Farm, they canceled me instantly from my parents' policy, so I had to get my own. But anyway, so that's my Subaru story. I do remember that Subaru though, because it seemed like, yeah, they all had those issues. They had the radiator just overheated, which is kind of crazy. You would think they could figure that out, but maybe they didn't.
Yeah, so like my understanding of the company was that back in the day they were all kind of like custom made.
Oh, and, really?
You know, it was like a custom shop, and then eventually they were bought up by
bigger.
Who. Somebody told me this. And this is all
hearsay,
yeah, so yeah. I don't know the accuracy of this. This is what I was told, and like somebody bought them and kind of turned them. And I want to say it was like Volkswagen bought them and turned them into like, you know, factory made product. Instead of a custom made product. And they were, you know, it was somebody, because they saw mine and it was a 92. They're like, that might have been the year they kind of switched it over.
Oh, so there was a period where they were good, then they got bad. Is that sort of thing happened?
I that was sort of as what it was explained to me as. Yeah. But, you know, when you're purchasing a $1,600 car,
yeah,
that is probably the least.
Exactly. You can't expect much for 60. I mean, yeah.
Yeah,
gotcha.
Yeah, it was a good time.
Good. So you're a Toyota guy, and I'm a Toyota person now too. Come back to Toyota. So good. Okay. All right, Mark. Well, I think you know, this has been fun. I think we'll leave it there, and we'll send everybody out to bonefishtarpontrust.org if they have questions for you. And yeah, I just want to thank you for definitely shedding light on all this. I think the work you guys are doing is amazing, and definitely appreciate you. And look forward to keeping in touch.
Yeah, Dave, I just want to say thank you for the opportunity to kind of share what we're doing with everybody, and thank you for all you do to kind of bring awareness to different conservation issues. So thank you. Thank you for having me on, and it was super fun to chat with you.
Okay, your call to action today is to go over to bonefishtarpontrust.org and check in with them. Maybe drop them a line, purchase something there on the website, support them in any way you can, find out more, tons of education, tons of good stuff. You can check in right now with our current giveaway, wetflyswing.com/giveaway. Right now, you can find out what is going on and how you can enter to win the giveaway. The big trip we have going is the giveaway to Belize, a place that that I haven't been to yet, and I'm hopeful that I will be there someday soon. And but we've got this big trip. We're working with Blue Horizon, one of the great outfits and lodges out in that part of the world. We're going to be doing some more stuff with them. So if you get a chance, you want to sign up to win this this trip and all the gear, wetflyswing.com/giveaway. All right, I hope you enjoyed that one. I'm going to hop out of here right now, and I just want to wish you a happy morning, a happy afternoon, or a happy evening wherever you are in the world. And I hope you are having a great day, and I look forward to seeing you on that next episode.